It's Friday morning, another episode of the Zogby Report, real and unscripted. Always fun with my son Jeremy. I'm John. And what we do is take a look at the big news of the week, often from two distinctly points of view, but at times moments of agreement, but always love, affection, and respect. Is that right, Jer? I get it right?
That's the name of the game.
That's the name of the game. Hoping to be a role model for others. No names needed, just others. And so it is real unscripted, but hey, this week it's kind of inevitable what we're going to talk about, right? Afghanistan, to be sure. That's the elephant in the room, and we can't skip that. And we have some polling, actually. Some of you have seen it in the news release form that we sent out. However, we're going to talk about it and talk about what it means and what it could mean for the future of the Biden presidency. And then Jeremy has some interesting polling. Do you want to give a quick preview, and then we'll take that as the second section of the podcast?
You know, I'm going to keep our listeners in suspense.
Oh, all right. Okay. Going to be like that, huh? Real unscripted. All righty. So, Afghanistan. First, the numbers, and then the commentary. So our poll of August 16th, almost 1,000 likely voters nationwide. And what we discovered was that overall job approval for President Biden stayed at 52%. Significant number, because that's the percentage that he got when he was elected. And yes, he was elected to office last November. So in other words, no harm, no foul, I guess you can say. He's kept not only his overall performance rating, but as we saw digging deeper into the poll, he's pretty much kept much of the Biden coalition together. His support in terms of his job performance, strong among blacks and Hispanics, non-whites in general, younger voters, Democrats, liberals, progressives, and so on. Where he has suffered a bit is that he won with a strong support from independents back in November, and independents are split on his job performance rating right now. So he's got to beef that up. But at this point in time, he has not been hurt. Now, from there, we asked about support or opposition to the president's execution, implementation of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And there it was 49% who support and 37% who oppose, and the rest, a pretty decent sum, about 20% or so, who were undecided, were not sure. Once again, he counted on support from liberals and progressives and Democrats. He did get on this question 26% support among Republicans. Usually what we see are Republicans in single digits when it comes to anything that a Democratic president does, vice versa with a Republican president, to be fair. But in this instance, more support among Republicans than we might have imagined. And so, in short, as we sit right at this moment and this tragedy, this catastrophe unfolds, the president is not in bad shape in terms of public opinion. And my suggestion to you, Jer, before I ask you for comment, is that purely in terms of the political equation here, whatever fallout may have come or will come, I guess the president decided better to get it done and over with in August, early September of 2021, than to have an evacuation and a discussion and condemnation of his actions in May of 2022, when folks are starting to think in earnest about the congressional elections. I'll have more to say, but what do you think and how do you see it?
I always have to go back to geopolitics. The kind of domestic politics and the, you know, does this look good for the president and is this bad for a president? I think that's kind of a minor sideshow. But I have a question because, you know, there's so much imagery in the coverage. If you follow this, you know, probably the one image that stands out because it's been played over and over are the Afghan people running along the tarmac, mm-hmm. holding onto the plane to give this imagery to the world and to Americans, especially and citizens, you know, within the NATO alliance, that they need us and it's pulling at our heartstrings. Don't go, please don't go. But what's really strange here is the military were evacuated before the personnel. And so we still have thousands of Americans there who are stranded. But not only that, a lot of weaponry was left behind. I don't know the number of Black Hawk helicopters, but it was a lot. And so
substantial.
The right wingers are jumping on that. And I hate to use that term. The Republicans are jumping on that. And to them, this is a Biden blunder. This is just the proof that Biden is stupid. You know, Biden has no brain, or if he has a brain upstairs, it's fried. And I don't buy that. I don't think that this was pure stupidity. I don't believe for one second that military intelligence and military just forget about their assets and say, oh, you know, shoot, you know, we were flying over Syria or we were flying over Iraq. And then we just realized we left about 1,000 Blackhawks behind. I don't know what's going on with that, but it begs the question, what's next? And I have some thoughts. And so I want to ask you before I go on. What's your interpretation? So you gave the domestic side of, you know, preparing for the midterm elections, but on the geopolitical front, what are the implications of leaving behind so much weaponry and getting the military out first, you know, getting them out quickly, and then those thousands of Americans still being stranded there?
Well, first off the top of my head, in terms of geopolitics, the United States lost another war. That comes as no surprise because after 2002, certainly 2003, we were clearly on a path to not defeat the Taliban. There were, you know, certainly some ups and some downs and some considerable tragedies that took place on the American side and on our allies' side all during it. But there was never an exit strategy and an exit strategy with a victory. And we can talk today in retrospect and say, well, women went to school, women went back to college, women started businesses. There was all this progress, but the lurking shadow, all of those years, better part of two decades, was that the Afghanistan government was never more than the city of Kabul. That the Afghanistan government never appeared to have the hearts and minds or the security or the will to serve the Afghan people. And so we were carrying a burden that we probably shouldn't have carried and that this was not going to end well. I think we all kind of knew that. Geopolitically, mark it as a loss. Secondly, because he asked geopolitically, it is a second stage in the decline of the American empire and the sense that, oh, why don't we just bomb them back to the parking lot? We used to hear that into a parking lot. Used to hear that during Vietnam where we have so much military capacity. We have nuclear weapons. Well, that doesn't produce any victories. That doesn't win any hearts and minds. We are a declining empire just as other empires are declining empires. empires today too. But this, in both respects, was a major loss for the United States. And then thirdly, any attempt at assessing partisan blame is totally disingenuous. It was an ideological Republican administration that got us involved in this war and got us in too deep. It was Barack Obama who tried to get us out and then had limits in terms of getting us out, knowing full well that there'd be problems on the ground. And how do you justify to Gold Star parents and to those who those on the ground who have lost their lives or limbs that we're pulling out, this was all a mistake and sorry that you had to suffer. You then had Donald Trump, who clearly did announce May 1st, we're getting out, and there shouts of support at those MAGA rallies. And then when we do get out, it's Donald Trump initially saying, look, this was all botched. And initially, we've got to take care of these refugees. And the Biden administration, he's right on this, had no plan for the refugees. But then Trump sees the videos of those refugees at the Bagram Air Base and then says, well, they're not coming here to the United States. This was always going to be a mess. The president of the United States, Joe Biden, totally botched this evacuation. You know, you look at all those people. I know I'm talking a lot, but look at all those people. If they had boarding passes for planes, could they have been processed in the matter of a couple of days just with regular boarding passes? Obviously not. They could not have been processed. Imagine now that verifications are needed. Taliban is surrounding the airport, has closed all other roads out, and now we're saving this evacuation, ill-planned, and all after American troops have left. Biden administration really blew it, and that's the question that is going to have to be asked at congressional hearings and by the press and public.
Well, you know, my question is, now that you have the troops gone or exited, where do they go now? Because, you know, listen to this. You go back to 1996, and I've mentioned this paper before. Benjamin Netanyahu wrote a paper called A Clean Break, in which he called for regime changes in seven nations. Now, even Wesley Clark, there's footage of him telling the story, affirming that notion. I mean, you could look it up for yourself. But Wesley Clark tells a story in this video that you can find on YouTube that some higher up came to him and said, we're going to war in seven nations and we're doing regime changes. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Sudan, and I don't know if I said Syria or not. I can't remember what the seventh one was. But
that seems like seven.
It would probably be Iran, which we haven't, you know, gone to war with
Yemen.
Yet.
Probably Yemen, I think you missed.
Yeah, well, yeah, well, in Bibi's paper, A Clean Break, I don't believe Yemen was mentioned, but I can be wrong about one. The others we know. But the point is we had regime changes essentially in almost all of those countries. Syria, there's still the attempt to take out Assad. That hasn't happened yet, but clearly a lot of effort to remove Assad. They had removed the Taliban, but now the Taliban are back. So, I mean, it's basically like you can go through that list and check mark. And so the question is because, you know, we know that the Department of Defense and the Pentagon are never done with warfare. I mean, I was just talking with somebody the other day, and I've made this observation myself. If you're under the years of under the age of 30, you have seen nothing but warfare. So if you were born in 1991, there was Desert Storm, and shortly after that, there were the Balkan Wars, and then there was part two in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and Libya, and Syria and so on and so forth. So I don't think the Pentagon and the military intelligence are done. So if they're taking the troops out, it begs the question, where are they going? I think that this is a repositioning of geopolitical strategy, that somebody made a decision, phase out Afghanistan, at least in this stage, and move towards, I don't know, maybe South China Sea, maybe focus on Taiwan. Of course, we are in the middle of a new Cold War. The rhetoric against Russia has only been intensifying. That goes back to about, really, you started to really notice that with the Obama administration. It's at an all-time new high as we speak. And then, of course, there are those in the Pentagon who have it in for China. They in one way, I don't think it's necessarily a direct war that they want, because nobody would win in that situation, but a proxy war. And so when I see this abrupt exit and all of a sudden it's been decided, get the troops out, my question is, where do you focus all of that energy to? I don't think they're coming back home and they're going to be on vacation and they've done their duty. I think the military are going to be repositioned somewhere else.
Well, I hope you're wrong. And I will say this, that we've done work for CENTCOM and for AFRICOM, for the military. And military brass are among the smartest people I've ever worked with and met over the years. And if there are any folks that are anti-war or anti-positioning ourselves for the next war, it is indeed the military brass. But, you know, with that said, it's one thing to be talking about Vietnam, which at the time was a country that was split, that was smaller. I mean, today it's 100 million people unified, and it's a tremendous economic engine in Southeast Asia. But at that point in time when we were involved, a smaller country because it was split down the middle. And then, you know, we're talking about Iraq and Lebanon and Afghanistan. And now listen to the conversation. We're talking about Iran, a country of 80 million people with a massive army. We're talking about Russia, historically one of the great armies, albeit an underfed one, but one of the great armies in the world. China, is anybody serious about China? These wars are going to be fought as cyber wars. They're also going to be fought as economic wars. You know better than almost anybody on the planet about the new Silk Road. And the new Silk Road, you know, we used to say about China that economically in these countries along the Silk Road and then moving on into Latin America, they're doing all the right things. They're investing in capacity and infrastructure, building trade relationships, and so on. Now, they have been depending as well on smart power. The fascination that people have, regardless of social class or geography, with Chinese history and culture, the mystery and the beauty of it all. And the Chinese are building museums, winning hearts and minds while they're creating capacity for other countries. If we're going to stop China, we're going to stop China and its cyber mischief capacity. And then we're also going to stop China by, as the president announced with the G7, a new counter Silk Road initiative. I want to tell you really quickly, we did this poll 17, 18 years ago, the Arab Thought Foundation, based in Beirut, and it was about multiple Arab countries and their attitudes towards the U.S. And very briefly, what they said was, this is the public. Don't talk to us about democracy. We have our government, we have our needs, we have our culture. We know what we want and when we want it. If we want the United States involved, we want capacity. We want help with healthcare, help with schools, help with trade, help with the kinds of things that can help on an equal and even mentoring footing, internships, better job opportunities. But don't start lecturing us about democracy. It seems as if China has a greater head start on that. They have no democracy really to talk about. What they go in via selfish interests is dominate world trade and local economies by the power of their economic resources. And so that's just a caution. I don't think the military is looking for another place. And I hope I'm right.
Well, look, there's been no shortage of inflammatory language.
No.
Especially with the Biden administration. With Obama, it wasn't so much inflammatory language. They were starting new wars. And of course, George W. Bush used inflammatory language and started wars. If you go back by the trend, you go back to Eisenhower's warning of the military-industrial complex, and you look at not only the covert wars that we've had over the decades, but the overt wars. And then you look at the last 10 years and either the inflammatory language or the action of meddling into the affairs of other nations, it's hard to believe that all of a sudden this is going to come to a grinding halt. The language towards China, I mean, the elements within the Pentagon actually believe that the Chinese have no right to oversee their sphere of the South China Sea. I mean, that would essentially be like China saying, stay out of the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. Stay out of the Caribbean Sea. It's absurd. It's sheer nonsense. But I mean, that unfortunately is the nature of war. And I'm going to quote a seminal book here, especially if you are anti-war minded or tend to be weary about war, then you should know about General Smedley Butler, perhaps the most decorated general in American history, who oversaw was commander in chief of the U.S. Marine Corps in World War I and World War II, who wrote this book called War is a Racket. I mean, this is coming from one of the most decorated generals in military history, who starts out the book by saying, I was a hatchet man for United Fruit. I was a hatchet man for Dole, for Standard Oil, and for J.P. Morgan. They would send me into a country with a brigade. We would topple the regime, and we would put in somebody more friendly to those folks. And it hasn't changed. So I think we need to start holding our leaders accountable regarding their inflammatory language. And I think we need to put an end to this mess before we get something much bigger than what we can handle. And right now, I don't see that happening. Coming from the leadership, it's going to have to come from the ground up.
Now, we promised a surprise. You've got some polling data that you worked on that changes the topic a bit. You didn't want to talk about it at the very beginning, so drum roll, here you go. Floor is yours.
Well, I have to say I was shocked, and I put these questions alongside yours, so they were in a bunch of questions that were politically oriented, you know, about U.S. politics. And so what I learned is that, and I'm learning this more and more, if you poll about partisan topics, you're going to get partisan results. But mm-hmm. Can you find a supermajority? Can Americans even imagine that there is a supermajority literally under the surface waiting to burst out? Let me demonstrate. Back in October of 2020, I wrote the ninth issue of the Intelligencer. It was called The Search for Common Ground. And it was exactly that in the polling. I wanted to find if there could be any common ground amidst all this hyper-partisanship and hyper-polarization. And two of the questions were about reform that a lot of people have been talking about, but it's never happened. But I wanted to know, what was there any intensity toward it? And so the first one was, do you agree or support term limits for congressmen and women, for senators, and I had to throw in there federal bureaucrats, because you know, federal bureaucrats wield a lot of power, especially over a lifetime. It's not like they go in for 4 years or 8 years. They stay in they tend to stay in for 30, 40, if not 50 years. And so 83% agreed to term limits for all three of those power players. I thought that was amazing. Of course, that was overall. So you can imagine if that was overall, it was just as high party-wise. I can't remember off the top of my head, but within Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, it was all either low 70s, mid 70s, or low 80s. It mirrored the overall. The next one was removing corporate PAC money from campaigns and elections. That one got 87% support. Imagine that. I mean, when's the last time we saw anything like that? So that was back in October 2020. And one of the things I wanted to throw in there, because I've had this idea, you know, we've seen recently that across the nation, police forces have been requiring police officers to wear body cameras. It's an attempt to regain trust, to have transparency and accountability because of the awful situations and cases we've had with police brutality. And so I thought, well, huh, what could really regain trust? Because we are amidst this situation now where there's an all-time high of mistrust towards government. So the question was, would you support a law requiring high-level federal bureaucrats to wear body cameras while at work? And so in the style of those questions that I asked back in October, we got about the same results. 79% of the overall public agreed that that was something that they could get on board with. So what does this mean? Okay, I've already said it. If you step away from, if you ask partisan questions, you get partisan results. If you try to find common ground, you can actually find a supermajority. What do those three things have in common that all obtained received supermajority support? They are all major overhauls of the status quo. They are all radical reform. They're basically Americans can get behind in droves. They can agree that the way forward is not fighting with each other, but overhauling the status quo. And I'm just amazed by that, and as well as relieved that whether it's Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, there's that much intense support. There's a lot of intense fighting, again, when it's in the current narrative of hyper-partisanship, but when you change the narrative to serious and radical reform, they all fall in line. And I think that is the top story.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, and I'm only going to, we're about 30 minutes right now. I'm just going to suggest that I personally agree. I love the notion of term limits, for starters, for bureaucrats. I don't think the government service was ever really meant to be a permanent service. It's not only that power could corrupt, but it's also that sometimes freshness outweighs long community history. That sometimes what you need to do is do a turnover and prevent people from getting too comfortable. You know, let them go out after 10 years or so. And, you know, providing we can do the economic planning on this, get back in, get into the private sector and allow private sector people to come in and run the government. The other thing is, I don't think it's a radical idea to have body cameras for bureaucrats. I'm not in any way demeaning or denigrating bureaucrats or the work that they do, but it is to say that this is becoming a pervasive part of our lives, and their work influences so many aspects of our lives. Here and there, there are folks, whether it's a small local village government all the way up to a large federal agency, there are folks that do things that they shouldn't be doing, and they need to leave a paper and a video trail, at the very least, to discourage this kind of behavior. Laws and these kinds of safeguards are never meant for the good, honest souls, the millions who go to work every day and do what they should be doing. They're always created for that handful that make life a mess for their colleagues and for the American people. So I would have checked off yes to those as well.
I have to ask you, what about taking corporate PAC money out of campaigns and elections?
I've always favored that. And, look, we've worked for corporations. We've worked for very nice and wonderful people. I know that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution regards corporations as groups of people, hence groups of people with the same rights and privileges under the Constitution that individual people have. But I think that that's where it stops. The possibility, the reality of having too much influence over government. I'm either a local councilman or I'm a congressman. Whose call am I going to take? Am I going to take the neighborhood lady whose husband is having a problem with veterans benefits, or am I going to, on the other line, is a person representing a giant corporation who contributed thousands of dollars to my campaign? It's just natural, and the way to do it is to end it. There's no need for corporate money.
Well said. Better than I stated.
So why don't we close off then on a happy note? And more importantly, on my note.
Sure.
All right. Okay.
Kick off the weekend.
All right. This was fun.
It's very fun.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Please spread the word. Please write to us and let us know what you're thinking. And we'll see you next week. So long, Jer.
Take care. Yep. Take care.